All right. Well, I'm glad you came for the last session of the season, not for the year, because we will start up again September 14, 2016. My plan is that we'll continue our travel log in September. You got a whole summer to change my mind. But since we didn't finish, I think we should finish the trip. We're going to be up north today, so we have, you know, I'm trying to think of how many lessons would it take to get done. But then I can do Egypt. I should do Egypt. I should also do Jordan. And so maybe it'll take us up to Christmas. And that'd be a nice break and come back with something. And then I got to thinking, have we talked about how this is all going to end? I mean, in this series? That is kind of interesting, isn't it? It's called prophecy. It seems like we did a section of it in the beginning. I was going to go back and look at that. Remember I said we're going to do it in the beginning because there's never time to do it at the end. It always gets cut short. So I think I did it in the beginning. So that wouldn't be really... Well, maybe we'll come back and review it or something. But the land is there in the end. Remember, some of you were in our studies. The land will not go away. It is not a... You know, since God made it, it will not go away because he cursed it and he can lift the curse. So Satan had nothing to do with that. Sin did, but God cursed it because of sin. Anyway, we could maybe finish up on that. Or whatever might come up while we're gone. All right. Well, we were at Dan last week, and we were at Caesarea Philippi, and we were at Nimrod, but we're in that area. And tonight, I think the lesson might be a little lighter, although we talk about war, and that's not light, but since it's contemporary for much of us, many of us our age, you know, it's not as heavy because we are real interested in it. When it's real interested, then somehow it's not as heavy. So we'll spend a lot of our time in the Golan and leave it there pretty much. There's a few things we need to do before we get to Galilee, but we'll wait for that for next fall. You're looking at the Hula Valley, which you've seen many times. It is a beautiful valley. It's a well-watered valley. There are four streams that collect and form the Jordan River, and they all come from my right, your right, your left. Not just same for you as it for me. Your right. And that becomes the watering system for this wonderful green earth now, which since Israel has been back in the land in 48, they have been making this another Garden of Eden. In fact, you know, the Bible talks about the earth will be like the Garden of Eden. So, I mean, it's not an exaggeration to think in that direction. Now, it's not there yet, but it certainly made some great strides in that direction. So a little bit of the map here. This is the tourist map, and we're up here in Dan, and here's Benias. Remember, they can't see P, so we got B. And then we have Masada. Not the Masada down south, is called Masada of the North. It's the Druze village. We'll visit there today. So we're going to basically take this route and come down here. I could not find for sure exactly where Bentol is, but it has to be somewhere in here. I don't know why it's not marked on the map. And that's where we'll spend our time because it is a Syrian overlook, look into Syria. And we'll look at it a couple of ways. We had one of our trips was in wintertime, and I wanted to show you those pictures, what this looks like with snow on the ground. All right, so we're up there, and today we'll do a Syrian bunker, which is an overlook of the Hula Valley. In fact, the picture I just showed you, this picture, is from a bunker. In fact, you see these rocks here in front. That is part of the bunker, and I'll talk about this. But the idea here is that this is where the Syrians had their gun mounts, and they were shooting into the Green Valley with their mortars into farmland, schoolhouses, homes. So everybody spent the night, the kids spent the night in shelters for years because they never knew when one was going to become flying. So we have the Syrian bunker to overlook called the Tap Road. We'll talk about that. We would have lunch at Masada usually. In the wintertime we didn't because of the snow. Then we'll do Bentol and the Syrian border, and end up telling you a little about the Eli Cohen story and the eucalyptus trees. I find these pictures, and I can't help but bring them to you. This must have been done with one of those cameras you do like this, you know. So you got this big wide landscape of the Mount Hermon Range, and there's no snow on it, which is unusual. And the top of the range is actually the border between Israel. Israel's on our side. Oops, I can't draw very well. Somewhere in here, this side is Lebanon, and this side is Syria. Now, Syria would go way over this way. So I think it's a really pretty picture. Not mine, of course, but somebody did it, put it up. It's the highest mountain of Israel. At the top of the crest is the border between Lebanon on the left and Syria on the right. And another corresponding picture is the valley of the Hula Valley. Again, taken across, looks like with the wide-angle camera. And we see a river. Barely can see it here. Be the Upper Jordan River, collecting the water as it goes down to the Sea of Galilee. And on the right, we have the Golan Heights. And you see how high they get back in here. In fact, this is where we're going to be with our Bentel, is what it's called. And then you come to these high plains where they're developing, and we're not going to visit that yet. We're going to leave that. All right, so we have 7 million people living in Israel today. Half of the Israelites that exist or Jews that live there are living in Israel already. And it's always been a question about how many people can the land support. Remember, the British mandate said that the few people that were living there at the time of the British mandate that couldn't sustain anymore. Well, it was by the standards of the Turkish farmers. They couldn't sustain what they had. They ruined everything. But when you take care of the land, it can absorb many, many more. So our overview of the land, and we'll continue to look at that as we finish our study even next fall, the land is showing that there are many, many, many areas that are still open and unoccupied and unproductive yet. So this picture of the Hula Valley is just a reminder that many more millions will fit easily into the land as we have today. In fact, you look at that, you'd have to look hard to find out where there is some development, but there are some places. So, and this is just the valley. So many more people than are there now. Now, to give you a perspective of what we're doing here, in case you think this is a travelogue, there's a background to this. And we start in Ezekiel 34. And I challenge you to read these verses if you have never, and even kind of study them. In fact, it'd be a great study for us to have. Ezekiel 34 through Ezekiel 39 develops this idea of Israel back in the land. And Ezekiel is a really interesting book because it talks about judgment of Israel, but it doesn't talk about judgment like in the tribulation. In fact, you don't find the tribulation in the book of Ezekiel. But you find judgment in it, but not tribulation per se. But what you do find is Israel being restored. They're being judged, yes, but they're going to be restored. So we have verses I selected out of mostly 34 to remind you why we study this. Because there is a prophetic aspect to what we're studying or to the land that we're studying. Ezekiel 34:11 starts out, "For thus says the Lord God, behold, I myself will search for my sheep and seek them out." The Lord will seek them out. Verse 13, "I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries and bring them to their own land. And I will feed them on the mountains of Israel, by the streams and by the inhabited places of the land." Now, we've looked at the streams. Later on, it talks about the mountains of Israel and the streams. We've seen those. And those are the places that we're talking about. Now, the enemy has said, now, enemy, you could put in there Arab, because that's kind of who their enemies are. The enemy has said, "Thus says the Lord God, because the enemy has spoken against you." You know, they think God has spoken against Israel. They say, "Ah, the everlasting heights have become our possessions." Who claims the land? Are we missing that point? No, these enemies are claiming the land. So God says that's what they're going to do, exactly what they are doing. That's Ezekiel 36:2. This is Ezekiel 36:5. "Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, surely in the fire of my jealousy I have spoken against the rest of the nations, against all Edom, who appropriated my land for themselves as a possession with wholehearted joy and with scorn of soul, as if to drive out a prey." You know, how many times have we heard that Israel is going to be driven into the sea? They're going to be driven off from the face of the earth. Exactly what God said they were going to do. Verse 8, "But you, O mountains of Israel." Now, he personifies these mountains as people that think and do. "But you, O mountains of Israel, You will put forth your branches and bear your fruit for your people Israel, for they will come soon. So it's like as if the branches of the trees, the vegetation, the streams, the mountains are getting ready for their homecoming, for the homecoming of the Jews. Verse 24, for I will take you from the nations, gather you from all the lands and bring you into your own land. Verse 38, 34, the desolate land will be cultivated instead of being a desolation in the sight of everyone who passes by, which is the way it was under the Turks and for 2,000 years nearly. They will say, this desolate land has become like a garden of Eden. Have I said that? Yes, and it looks like it. And the waste, the desolate, and the ruined cities are fortified and inhabited. We do not see a vacant country. Then the nations that are left around about you will know that I, the Lord, have rebuilt the ruined places and planted that which was desolate. I, the Lord, have spoken and will do it. Now, in these verses quoted, we see a process. It's in play. It is working out in our lifetime. Israel is back in the land in unbelief. True, but the blessings of being in the land are already working because the people are in the land. What remains for complete redemption is for the heart to be made clean and new. This will happen at the time of the second coming. But for now, Israel waits her obedience and for the work of the church to be completed. Then we have the fulfillment of the new covenant promises of Jeremiah 31:31, made to Israel. And it says there in 36:26, starting there, moreover, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes. And you will be careful to observe my ordinances, and you will live in the land I gave to your forefathers, so that you will be my people, and I will be your God. That's why we're studying the land, because it has a future. And the people that have been promised the land have a future. It may not be the generation we see there now, according to Matthew 21:43, talks about there will be a generation come that will be worthy of it. And so that's what we wait for. Maybe the generation we see now, I don't know. But we see the effects of people in the land already as part of God's promises being fulfilled. Ezekiel goes on to talk about they're in their stage of dry bones first, and then they will come to life at the second advent. So we're in the dry bone stage, but it's exciting to watch. Since we talk about Israel now and the Golan Heights, it's sometimes kind of a mystery exactly what this is. The heights are actually heights. They're up elevated like a step. And let's just move through my text here, whether I repeat myself too many times. So we now continue in the north, moving out of the Hula Valley to the Golan Heights. Now, for our study tonight, there are no, except what I already read, there are no significant biblical sites in this location to mention, but the area is important in modern and prophetic day Israel seeking independence and security, defending against belligerent Arab aggression. Today, Syria border is relatively quiet, and I got to say relatively quiet here because in the last year it's been more difficult. In fact, I don't even know whether they allow you to go there. I will show you the border in a little video clip I have. When we were there, I'll say this now because I'll probably forget it, we heard bombs in Syria. We saw the smoke. Now, Syria is really careful where they throw the bombs, because if they throw one into Israel, they get a couple, three or four back. So they do, and if they didn't make a mistake, they say, well, I can see one mistake, but there better not be another one. So there is this understanding the bombs don't fly over. So you stand fairly comfortable and not being worried at all that they're aiming at you. Not because you have a stray rocket come through that wouldn't be good, but it didn't happen. So I don't know whether you can go there today or not. We'll find out. Here's my little clip. Now, the audio is horrible, and what the man is saying, our guide is saying, is he's pleading the case, he's pleading the cause that for his son, he has no place to go. He says, the Christian nations have their countries, and you have many, he says. The Arabs have many countries, but we only have one country. And if we're not here, where can we go? Now, that's what he's saying, so I'm sorry if it's a little bit too noisy with the wind. You are going to run, aren't you? There she goes.
It's not easy. This is the price we have to pay to live in this country. It's a very heavy price. Very heavy price. But this is the price we're ready to pay.
It's the price we're ready to pay.
I don't have another place.
You don't have another place.
No. Many, many Christian countries in the world.
Many, many Christian countries.
Many, many Muslim countries in the world. There's only
Muslim
one Jewish country in the world.
And only one Jewish country.
New Jersey. Oh, it's called Israel. It's called number six.
Anyway, that's what he says. Now we swing over and see Syria, and the part that's developed is still Israel. And the part that's not developed out further is Syria. It's a marked difference, isn't there? All right. Just see if that worked, and it did, kind of. All right, so we have the territory. Is this really Israel's territory? That kind of has come up in my mind. Well, if you go back, the Girgashites are listed over here. That's going way back. And then we have, in what we call the time of Jesus, we have this area would be called the Decapolis. Deca, Greek, 10 Greek cities. Well, they really weren't part of Israel, although they were part of the Roman Empire, and one of the Herod's sons, Philippi, ruled over this area. But, you know, so we have a little bit of difficulty to know exactly what's Israel, what's not Israel, and under Solomon's reign, it was part of Israel. And during the time of Jesus, it seemed like it wasn't so much, so what's the deal here? And then when it comes to the UN partition, it did not include the Golan as part of what was given to Israel. Now, of course, they took a lot away from Israel in the partition, in of the new UN in 1947. So this is kind of now a disputed area because of the wars we'll talk about. But this is the Golan Heights. It goes down below the Sea of Galilee, and then it would have come up along the shore here. And so this in here would have been the Golan Heights. At least that was the disputed areas. This would be the Syrian Golan Heights, called the disputed area. And in the British mandate, which was given to the Jews, it is included as part of what was supposed to be for the Jews. Now, they didn't get it, but in the original mandate, it was there for them. So I'm saying this because just how much right does Israel have to this land? Well, it ends up being a security issue, probably more than a land expansion issue, which I'll talk about. So right now, let's get the details here. Between 1948 and 1947, Syria controlled the Golan Heights. We're talking about this strip and the strip that goes way down. And on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, they controlled the Golan Heights and used it as a military stronghold from which its troops randomly sniped Israeli citizens in the Hula Valley and the Jordan River Valley, forcing children living in kibbutzim to sleep in bomb shelters. In addition, many roads in northern Israel could be crossed only after being cleared by mine detection vehicles. In late 1966, a youth was blown to pieces by a mine while playing soccer near the Lebanon border. In some cases, attacks were carried out by Yasser Arafat's Fatah, which Syria allowed to operate from its territories. Now here we see, obviously, the vertical is exaggerated, but you see the shape. Syria's up here, then we have this ridge line, which is where Bentel is going to be on this ridge line, and then it slopes off down into the Sea of Galilee, down into here would be the Hula Valley. So, you know, in military action, the person that has the elevation has always got the advantage because, you know, you can't see over, but they can look down on you. So that's the picture that we're looking at, the Golan Heights. Again, this is the picture I started out with before, mostly looking mostly northwest towards Dan. From a Syrian bunker, shelling originated from sites like these from 1948 to 1947. Now that is 19 years. 67, thank you. That's 19 years of this going on and on. So you'd have kids that knew nothing else but living in that kind of condition. On June 6, 1967, I'll get my dates right, 5 Arab nations were perched to attach Israel with the idea of wiping them off the face of the earth. We saw that in Ezekiel, didn't we? The Israelis were aware of their imminent threat, launched a preemptive strike on Egypt and Syria in the early morning, wiping out the Egyptian Air Force as the planes were sitting on the ground, and all the anti-aircraft missile sites in Egypt and Syria that now come on, control the skies. With the skies rid of the enemy, the Israelis easily will finish the war in 6 days. The war lasted 6 days legitimately because they were attacked and were on the verge of being attacked, and Israel gained the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Heights. This provided a better buffer between Syria in the north and Egypt in the south. The line was really at the Suez Canal, pretty much. And every picture of people living in bunkers for their nights, and it must have been difficult. And a lot of those kibbutzes were family. You know, there were some questions about socialist, you know, activities. So their families lived together, and their children were housed together. It didn't work out very well. But I just want you to know that that was going on. That's why you see these almost as a mixed family here. That's what they were. Now, international law, just in case you forgot what we talked about some months ago, international law is a law respected by all civilized, and I say thoughtful, reasonable nations. Agree that when a belligerent nation attacks another, the territories won may be disputed and are considered occupied by the aggressor. If somebody comes and takes my land, he may claim it, but it's not going to be exactly his because he did that. So maybe then it could be occupied because he's occupying my territory. However, reverse this, if the aggressor is defeated, they come in and I strip him of his wealth. If the aggressor is defeated or is being defeated, the territories they lose to the defender are not considered occupied, but legitimately gained due to the belligerence of the aggressor's nation. And that's the situation we have. Israel has taken land from an aggressor nation who attacked them, and we'll see this. And some might say, well, it was a preemptive strike. But no one argues that these five nations were on the verge of doing it, and Israel did a preemptive strike. But there's never been any discussion I've ever heard that Israel shouldn't have done this because Israel was not going to be attacked by these nations. No one's ever said that. So we just leave that go as a non sequitur or non-starter. Okay, this is the Israeli claim and status of the Golan Heights and the so-called West Bank territories. Both were legally lost by Syria and Jordan in 1967, since both acted in a miscalculated belligerency, expecting a victory. They lost their own territories to the victim nation, Israel. Why is this not the end of the discussion? I ask. It's beyond reasonable minds, yet the call for Israel to give up the occupied territories continues, including Syrian Golan. Well, from 1967 to 1973, these 6 years, the peace of Israel was continually threatened. Syria and Egypt had been soundly defeated, lost significant territories, but the national leaders think that this little pipsqueak nation, Israel, can be defeated with a planned coordinated attack, and Blank makes such plans for 1973. Now, the Israelis were complacent with an easy victory in 1967, and because of political hubris, did not act on the clouds of war forming in 1973. A second preemptive strike was really out of the question. I know Golda Meir wasn't the prime minister, and for her to make a strike would have been highly criticized because the nation could understand one preemptive strike, but two, so they sat on their thumbs because there were doubters and a lot of second guessers later. So we have the Syrian bunker from the Hula Valley, and we have, I read somewhere that's a Russian half-track, but I don't think it is. It looks too good for that. So I'm not sure what it is. It may be an American, but they said Russian, but it could be. Anyway, it was found or left at the Syrian bunker and memorial. So here we have this bunker, this kind of spot, and there's a tap line road, they call it a tap line. And there's a road that goes along with it to maintain the tap line. The road is along a petroleum pipe that came from Saudi Arabia. I'll talk about it in a minute. I just want you to know what we're talking about here. And the war is actually engaged from Syria. So now here's the Hula Valley, Jordan River. This is Israel territory, the shaded part. And when the Syrians came in, this is kind of like the Battle of a Bulge. Bulges in like this, and they got that far. So it was a threat, and what they were aiming for was this Nafka. This is the center of the military installation in the Golan Heights, Israeli. So they were aiming for this. Here's that pipeline road. I'll show you pictures about that in a minute. I don't want to make a big deal of the pipeline road, except it's just there. And it was along this line that most of the battles occurred. So the name Petroleum Road derives now from the defunct oil pipeline of the Trans-Arabian Pipeline Company, which the road runs adjacent to. The pipeline is, abbreviated, or originated in the oil fields of Saudi Arabia, then proceeded through Jordan and Syria until it reached the oil export terminal of Sidon on the coast of Lebanon. Now, it was really going to go to Haifa, but when Israel took over in 1948 and became an independent nation, they changed it and they went further north out of Israel territory. But now it's now in the Golan Heights. It now is, after the war, it's going to be under Israeli control. Even though Israel came to control the section of the tap line through the Golan after the 1967-60 war, it permitted its operation to continue. However, although it was the largest pipeline in the world, it was only 30 inches, it was now considered too small. When it was completed in 50, the tap line ceased operation in 1990 completely, and the Golan Heights section stopped in 1976. So it's not been operating in Israel for a long time. Well, since the road diagonally bisects the entire length of the northern portion of the Golan Heights, it was the site of many battles fought along its axis during the Yom Kippur War, and it had a road next to it, so that would be a reason too. So here's the road as it is today, and the battles were fought in these valleys. The Syrian bunker I've been showing you is this spot up here. And over this side, way down here, is where the Hula Valley is. And this way is Syria. Bus drivers don't like to go on this road because if you meet another car, what are you going to do? And when we went there, we didn't meet another bus, so we were okay, either coming in or going out. So I hope to go back there next time. So here's a picture from the war. This is that road. Now, I can't say it's exactly the same spot because I cannot make the horizon work out the same. You know, to do this class, you got to be a detective. Is this it or is this not it? Well, it has this bump, it doesn't have that. So I don't think it's exactly the same spot. If it is, it may be flipped over that we're looking at it from the other end. So I just wanted to tell you it's from the 67 war. Now, we have the Hula Valley. Syria launched mortars into the Israeli farm schools from this spot. Swinging a little bit further to the south. The same picture, and now swinging a little bit further to the north. And so here's our Dan, where we've been there. And here's a farm. I want you to keep your eye on the farm over here because I'm trying to find out, you know, what can I connect on two pictures that would say those are the same thing. So I figure out this farm's got to be the same thing. So way over here, this is Lebanon. This is Lebanon, all right? And to my right is going to be Nimrod. Caesarea Philippi is down in this area. Here's our farm, and we are on the way up to Nimrod, and this is the road. And we have a fair amount of elevation change as we go up to the Golan Heights. Again, Caesarea Philippi to the right. I spend more time looking at this than you care. I know, but it don't make sense to me. The Syrian bunker is to the right, to the left here, and we're going uphill this way, and there's our farm that we've been keeping our eye on. Now, we're in the bunker, the Syrian bunker. This is not at Bentel. This is the Syrian bunker overlooking the Hula Valley. And this is a group in 1911. And some of you are in there that I recognize. And obviously, it's been bombed. These rebars don't get bent like that from earthquakes. Well, maybe they do. I don't know. And the bunkers, obviously, are well fortified, dirt over the top, very thick piece of concrete. And underneath it, you sit. Now, I'm not a soldier, so I don't know that I'd feel safe with that concrete over me or not, because if it did come down, I'd be dead. So, but I guess you get used to that. And then they have these tunnels. These are Syria now. They could walk from their bunker to bunker, because Israelis would shoot back at them too. And when they did, they were pretty well fortified. You see how thick this iron is? That's probably a good inch and a half thick iron. Now, that's pretty tough. So here we have our half track before that I mentioned to you. And then we have the Valley of Tears. We crossed the road we came on is to my right. I look up higher and I see, here's Nimrod, what I call the Mount of Transfiguration. And over to the left is Caesarea Philippi, and some are over here in the, is where that farm is. I think that's how it works. That's why you can't go to Israel just once. You got to go and look more than once to figure it all out. And I can't figure this one out. This has to be, this Nimrod has to be over here, but I don't think it does. But it's got a nice kind of a earth tone building over here with no roof. So it's coming from that Syria bunker area. Again, Nimrod's castle. We see the farm. All right. Now, the Yom Kippur War, 1970. See, that was a 76 war. Now we're going to go to the 67 war. Now we're going to go to the 1973 war called the Yom Kippur War. War was fought on two fronts, not five. And it was only Egypt and Syria, not before it was Egypt, Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Now it's only two. Jordan did get involved in it a little bit to show like they were still Arabs, but they made no difference. And it was at the end of the war, and they did it just to be obedient. That is Jordan. Okay, so this is 73 war. And two fronts. One front would have been down here in the Sinai Peninsula. Remember, in the 67 war, all of this was taken by Israel. And they held it till 73. Now, 76 war, they took all of this. This would have been the border. Hello? This would have been the border of the 67 war. Am I getting the wrong dates here? Holler at me. So now these are new aggressions. Remember, Israel legitimately took this land because they were defending themselves, kept the land. And with this being a surprise attack, they pushed in a long way. Here's our headquarters for Israel. And we're going to talk about this spot, El Al, a little bit later. Megdal Shams, we talked about that, where the breach of the fence was when we were there in 2008. All right, and this is the Kirek Shimona. That's where those toy tanks were sitting, the blue, red, and yellow tanks that were from Russia. Remember those? That's why I got to have some interesting thing at every point, because that's how you remember. All right, in Egypt, there's Suez Canal, and this is where the war was fought. Okay, I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute. And I get rid of that. And here is the crossing of the Suez. The story is, on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the most sacred day in Israel, while most of the soldiers were in the synagogues, this was like our Sunday, it's their Sabbath, Egypt and Syria launch a coordinated attack on two fronts, one across the Suez Canal into the Sinai, the other on the Syrian border into the Golan Heights. This time, the war was a surprise to Israel, whose soldiers were far from the fronts and without their weapons. Inadequate roads and transportation slowed their progress to get to the fronts. Now, they tell us, what are you doing with all these new roads? We're building these roads so that this won't happen again. When our soldiers have to get to the front line, we don't know where the front line is going to be, but we have to have roads where they get there quickly. And so they're building these wonderful roads. So some of these deficiencies have been added, better roads, and all the military carry their weapons with them at all times. You've been there, you've seen this. Even in civilian clothes, they're not on duty, but they all carry their weapons, even the ladies. I always think it's probably ladies can defend their own lands too. Think of it not being an aggressive army, but they're a defensive armor, so everybody's armed. So they're really preparing for total war. Total war means everybody's involved. So the weapons they carry with them at all times. Now Israel had taken the Sinai in 1967. In 1973, the war front for Israel and Egypt was the Suez Canal. This gave Israel a bit of time before they get clear to proper Israel, gave a bit of time buffering the Egyptians while Israel dealt with the nearby and immediate threat of the Syrians and Golan. The Golan Heights, they're right at you. In Egypt, they were quite a ways away from Israel yet. And so they took that advantage of that. In the north, in the 1973 war, there was no geographical restriction to access the Golan, as the canal was for the Egypt in the south. And we see here, these are tank barriers. Now, there are places where even tanks can't go. If you can tip them over, they're done. So that's the idea here, to build this up here so they come over this. They really can't. They go nose down, and so they have to do something to get over it. They tried to bridge it over, and they have ways of doing that, except you see this one failed, and we have an upside-down tank here. And then the other way to do it, which seems to be a lot easier, is to bulldoze down the front and have a track they drive through it. But when you're doing that, you're being shot at. So it isn't exactly an easy thing to do. So we have no barrier here except this kind of thing. The tank barrier was more easily breached, and the canal and the Syrian tanks poured in against the unprepared Israelis. And they got a long way. Now, there is an interesting thing that happens here. You almost say there's a supernatural hand here. On the Golan Heights, approximately 180 Israeli tanks faced an onslaught of 1,400 Syrian tanks. That's almost one per 10. The objective for Syria was Nafa. I mentioned that to you. It's in a circle. The military headquarters. However, the left flank, be the south one, was virtually open and undefended. Down here, there was hardly any defense from the Israelis. If the Assyrians had exploited this route, they could have crossed the Jordan below the Sea of Galilee, cut off the north from the south, cut the nation in two, and likely defeated Israel. But it was not to be. I'll mention it a little bit more in a minute. By comparison, look at in the south, along the Suez Canal, fewer than 500 Israeli defenders and only 3 tanks were attacked by 600,000 Egyptian soldiers. I think that is, divide that up, that's a little over 1,000-to-1 ratio. And bracketed by 2,000 tanks, and we only had 3. And so that means 667 tanks per Israeli tank. And 550 aircraft on the Egyptian side. Now, you got to say, who's going to win this? So I say it's almost a miraculous thing. And what Israel did, they pulled off their people here and they went north because they had some time here. So the Syrian mechanized brigade had reached the religious settlement of Ramat Magashimin less than 1 hour after the students of Yeshiva, the school, there had been evacuated. Now, this is the unaccountable part. Unaccountable. The Syrian force halted down here. Just stopped. There's nobody down there. It could have walked right on in, except for a handful of men with Major Yar 5 miles down the road at El Al. There was nothing to prevent them from driving south another 20 miles into the Israel-Jordan Valley. To me, that's the miracle thing. They said, this is remarkable that they didn't do that. I don't know. Is it like, if you read the book, The Yom Kippur War, as I remember how this goes, the tank driver comes up to the spot, and he stops, you know, almost like you say, the bridge in sight, and he just stops. He wanted to go. And was he afraid? Did he afraid this is a trap? You know, and you don't know what God puts in the mind of the enemy to make him think something's happening. If you have watched any of those movies, I'm not sure how good they are. They call Against All Odds. They're done by Israelis, by an Israeli journalist. And he's trying to be inquisitive whether miracles really happen. So he goes and follows the Israeli army and recounts some of the things that they've gone through. And in these accounts, they come up with some miracles. I doubt some of them, but there's some of them might be true. I mean, where God actually, you know, caused the enemy to see something that really wasn't there, or at least it wasn't visible to the naked eye. So you have something like this happen, and we know that we let Ezekiel, that he's going to do this for the Israelis. So I don't want to put it past that God did something, you know, in the mind of the enemy here and caused them to stop for reasons we can't explain. But they did stop, and they could have gone ahead and would have looked like, from human point, the war outcome would have been different. So by the end of the fighting, 2,600 Israeli soldiers have been killed. Combat deaths for Egypt and Syria were 7,700 and 3,500 respectively. Ceasefire negotiations are always interesting. The winning side wants to delay ceasefire to extend the line to gain more land. Israel was winning but didn't want to go as far as Damascus, and they could have. They kept on going. They go to Damascus, and they said to each other, what do we want with Damascus? You know, so much for imperialism. They weren't interested in anything else but their land. So they agreed to a ceasefire. Then they held up and agreed to it. And the result was the Golan was in their secure hands. Now, 1973, I came on staff in fall of 1973, and before we came on staff, we took a trip to the East Coast, and we had one of those big boats, you know, called an Oldsmobile 98. That was a gas guzzler even in those days. And we were going to take a trip. My mother had died, and my dad had one date with Marilyn's mother-in-law, And so we're going to East Coast, and Marilyn's mother lived in the East Coast. And so I said, Dad, you want to go along? I said, sure. So he went with us, and that's why I know when it was, because it was in the summer of 1973. And we said, how are we going to go with this gas, you know, being a problem? Now, the embargo wasn't on yet. This part I don't remember. You'll have to tell me later if you don't know how this all works out. The gas embargo wasn't on, but gas was scarce. So we never let the gas tank go below a half before we filled in. So that was how we did it. And, of course, Nixon, with his bright idea to not ration gas, but just to put price control on it. So that was a total backfire. You know, they never done that again. You know, you don't control the price. You let the price go, and that'll take care of the supply. And the ones that really want to go and have the money will, and the rest of us will sit home. But anyway, at least there's no shortages like this. So it was during the October War, which was after we were in the East Coast. That was 73. We were there in summer. During the October War, the Arab oil-producing states imposed an embargo of oil exports on the United States, Portugal, and Holland because of their support for Israel. Now, interesting with Portugal, I just got the side issue. I don't have time for this. No, I don't have time for this. But Portugal is a place where the Jews went when they got kicked out of Spain. All the cartographers, you know, the map makers for sailing and for ocean New World discovery like Columbus, all those were Jews. And Spain kicked them out, and they went to Portugal. So Portugal became a powerful legal navigation nation. Anyway, it's interesting that Portugal shows up here as a friend of the Jews again. And Holland, which is a little strange to me. Why Holland? Because of the support for Israel. Anyway, the pact was to cause a shortage of petroleum in the United States and a quadrupling of the gas prices. Hang on to your seat, girls and boys. Americans soon had to contend with long lines at the gas station. On October 15th, OPEC struck back against the West by imposing an oil embargo against the United States, increasing the price by 70%. The American and Western European allies overnight, the prices of the barrel of oil went from $3 to $5. In January 1974, they raised it further to $11. You know where oil's been? It's been as high as, what, 130? Now it's probably back down to more in the 30, 40 age range. But then we talk about $3 oil. That's too cheap. Anyway, the United States and Netherlands in particular were singled out for their support of Israel in the war. As for the embargo, the Arabs lifted then again in 1974. And you never worry about the Arabs because they will run out of money so sooner than we'll run out of oil. And talk about this in a bit here. The NATO was, well, I'll read this, thrown into this defensiveness during the first 2 days of fighting. Israel mobilized its reserve, began to counterattack in the south. Israel forces were having little success in stopping the Egyptian onslaught in the south. Still, the Sinai Peninsula offered a large buffer zone between the fighting and the heart of Israel. Three tanks. The situation was different in the north, where the Syrians had swept across the Golan and could, in short order, threaten Israel's population centers. Consequently, most reserves meant for the Egyptian front were shifted to the Golan. The replenished Israeli forces stopped the Syrian advances, forced a retreat, and began their own march towards Damascus. The war started on the 6th of October, 1973, ended on the 25th, 19 days. On October 12, Nixon ordered an emergency airlift to Israel. Cargo planes carrying spare parts, tanks, bombs, helicopters flew around the clock to Israel. The resupply, here, get this, the resupply efforts were hampered by Americans' NATO allies who capitulated to Arab threats. Remember, don't ever capitulate to Arab threats because they, too, run out of things before we run out of oil. They run out of money. So threatened to allow American planes to use the airspace. They had to go to Portugal. I mean, somebody has been critical of NATO and our political arena. You look at that, and that's one of the reasons. One exception was Portugal, which as a consequence became the base of operation between October 14 and November 14, 1973. 22,000 tons of equipment were transported to Israel by air and sea. The airlift alone involved 566 flights to pay for the infusion of weapons. Nixon asked Congress for and received $2.2 billion in emergency aid for Israel. Interesting, isn't it? Okay, well, we got 15 minutes left here. We got a long way to go. All right, retracing our steps. Now, this is the lighter side of our story. Driving north in the Hula Valley in 2012. We're going to retrace our steps. Now, this picture is almost surreal to me. It doesn't almost look real. I mean, the clouds look fuzzy and the mountains look fuzzy and the trees look fuzzy. But I know it's not fuzzy because the cars are real. So, okay. Another picture without the cars. The valley floor, what elevation are there? Is there? I wrote, okay, we're going to skip that. I wrote that somewhere. Skip it, come to it later. So here's where we're going to go. We've been here. We swing around. We fly past Nimrod, and we go on to the Golan Heights. This little sign, Ain, means spring. And this little sign here is this little village here. You know, you got to watch these spellings. Q and K can be exactly the same pronunciation. So you look at these words kind of phonetically. And on the way up, this is during wintertime, they're selling their oranges, not oranges, apples and olives, and they make honey and all kinds of good things you can buy on the side of the road. On the way by, we see Nimrod, and we see Nimrod again. So what else is there? A little bit of snow. And this is from a different picture looking back on Nimrod going up. So Nimrod's not the highest peak. It's just the high peak, not the highest. And on the way up, we see, the sun's coming out. Not going to be so bad after all. We keep on going up. The clouds are still high or low. I'm sorry. Looking back over the valley and way off. No, this is still the Hula Valley. And we see a little more snow gathering, starting to accumulate. Now the bus driver is starting to have kittens. Because our guide had insisted that we go this day, or go up here. So as we go up, we said, you know what snow does when you get caught in your wheels? You know, it can grab you and go throw you into the... I'm thinking, do these guys know what they're doing in this stuff? I'm not so worried about the bus, because he's in good shape, but the car is coming at me, you know, it could easily be in the fence. So we keep going, and pretty soon we come to this look. I said, wow, look at this. People are stopping in the middle of the road. Somebody had a flat tire? No, they're looking at the snow. You know, some of these kids have never seen snow. Probably the adults have never seen snow. So this was the biggest snow they had in this area for 20 years. So the family discovers snow the first time for many. And they have to do the snow angels, just like they do everywhere else. And after a while, they get back in the car, and we move on. So say, so far, it's not too bad. We can watch these. By the way, these are Druze people. And I shouldn't call them Muslims. They don't want to be called Muslims. They're Druze. They come out of Islam, but they're not considered by many people Muslims. The Druze, Druze. So we drive a little further, and we come to the end of the progress, and all of a sudden, the bus is not moving anymore. And we slipped over to the side against the rail. And this, by the way, is a brand new bus. And he was very careful about his new bus. And once you got against the rail, you would consider yourself done. So we sat there. You can see we tried different things, which was a joke, you know, get the traction to the wheel. But he was done. Any farmer knows that he's done. So he looks back, and we're looking, and now what? I mean, we pushed, and the men couldn't push, and so we have to do something. So while we were waiting, we have this Druze mother. I showed you her picture and her son last time or a couple times ago. She comes walking by. I don't know where she's going. Didn't look like there's anybody lived there, but she's a Druze woman who has a son who is in a Jewish school because she wants her son to be in Jewish school because you get a better education. Another woman walks by. You know, it's just interesting. We just stopped there, had a lot of things to do. And now we have a Druze leader. He helps, I don't know who he's calling, probably his mother. I don't know. Mom, you just can't believe what I'm seeing here. But he's a Druze leader because he's got a red top. I'll show you that in a minute. So that kind of marks him off. So we sat there. Our guide name was Ruthie, and she was on the phone. I don't understand Hebrew, but I understand what she was saying. It was a non-ambiguous call to the equipment we needed, and there was no involved. It was you be here, but we still sat for 2 hours waiting for this guy to show up, and he didn't help us much. But he was trying to open the road up. They got good equipment. We waited about 2 hours. The road department came finally, and then a front end loader came, which really what we needed to pull us out. But, you know, the rescue crew failed to bring a tow rope, which is, you know, oh, yeah. So he improvised a come-along strap, you know what that is, and used it to pull the bus. But the first time he tried it, it broke, so I said, we may be here for a while yet. Or it's going to come through the windshield with, you know, the buckle. So anyway, I was sitting right there. But there is a rope hooked up here to one of these little teeth on this bucket. And so he was backing up. And so we were finally on the move. So it was only a quarter mile that we were to the top of the hill. We almost made it, as they say. So we're in this Druze village in Matada, And ordinarily on good days, this is where we have lunch. Again, it's a Druze, you see how I spell it. Masada is said the way you say it, except it's not the fortification that's down south. Now, the Druze permit, this talks about the people themselves. The Druze permit no conversions, either away from or to their religion. Marriage outside the Druze faith is rare, and is strong, in other words, you have another person come is rare, but it's discouraged. Many Druze religious practices are kept secret, even from the community as a whole. Only on an elite initiates, known as the knowers, participate fully in the religious services and have access to the secret teachings of the scripture. The Druze follow theophany and believe in reincarnation or transmigration of the soul. At the end of cycles of rebirth, which is achieved through the success of reincarnations, the soul is united with the cosmic mind. Sounds very Eastern, doesn't it? The Druze faith is monotheistic and Abrahamic, religion based on the teaching of whoever, including Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and Akhenaten, which is Egyptian. The Epistles of Wisdom is the foundation text for the Druze faith. The Druze faith incorporates elements of, get this, Islamism, Judaism, Christianity, Gnosticism, Platonism, Neoplatonism, Pythagoreanism, Hinduism, did I miss one? According to some and other philosophers and beliefs, created a distinct and selective theology known to esoterically interpret religious scriptures and to highlight the role of the mind and truthfulness. I mean, you got it all right there. Although dwarfed by other larger communities, the Druze community played an important role in shaping the history of the Levant, which is that strip along the Mediterranean Sea, and continues to play a large political role there. As an ethnic and religious minority in every country in which they live, they have frequently experienced persecution, even though the faith originally developed out of Islam. Druze are often not considered Muslims. The Druze social customs differ markedly from those of the Muslims or Christians and are known to form a close-knit, cohesive community, but also integrate fully with the adopted homelands. As I said, wherever they live, they are loyal to the country they live in. If they're within Israel, they're loyal to Israel. If they live within a Muslim country, they're loyal to them. And so you have these groups that live right on Majel Shams, which is on the border. They didn't know which one to wear. So when they come over the fence, they figure, well, we better be friends with those guys because they may be the winners. So it's kind of hard. And I know they make good pita bread. The reincarnation is a paramount principle of the Druze faith, and reincarnation often occur instantly at one's death because there is an eternal duality of the body and the soul, and it is impossible for the soul to exist without the body. The human soul will only transfer to a human body in contrast to Hindu and Buddhist belief system where souls can transfer to any living creature. Furthermore, the male Druze can only be incarnated in another male, and Druze and female Druze can only be reincarnated in another female. I guess they haven't read the law. Get that? A Druze cannot be reincarnated in the body of a non-Druze. Additionally, souls cannot be divided, and the number of souls existing in the universe is finite. I don't understand that. But the groups probably don't grow much. The cycle of the rebirth is continuous, and only way to accept it is escape it is through the success of reincarnations. When this occurs, the soul is united with the cosmic mind, achieves the ultimate happiness. You want to believe that? I got some land to sell you. I don't know where. Anyway, that's the story. Now, quickly, I just got some random pictures here that are kind of interesting as we pull through this little Druze village called Masada, and everybody's outside looking at the snow, and it was kind of beautiful, kind of like you go on a ski in it. And we get out of the city. And we are going to have to skip Bentol because this is where we'd make our turn. And the Bentol is up here, by the way. This is, you can see it. And we're not going to go there because we already got stuck once today. So it gets missed. So we're going to go around it on the bottom side of it, to the east side of it. And when we do that, we come across this old UN building abandoned and was active in 1983. And this is from 1983, a picture we stood looking into it, and you could not go any further than this, and there were guards guarding that road. I took this picture in 2012. This was taken probably in 11, and this was 1983. Some of you know Ron Ely, their children, John. John's a father, son-in-law, yeah. Well, he was on that first trip, and Song Lee was with us. He's the other guy here. So we were having a friendly time with his UN. You know, you never have to worry about the UN shoulders anyway, so we weren't worried. And we have this. Yeah, yeah. Don't tell him I showed the picture, okay? He'll pull me out of retirement, put me to work. Okay, so we have Bentol, quickly. Bentol overlooking the Syrian border from the Israeli side. And we see the cows in front. They're also called minesweepers. They do a good job. So we approach this mountain, now in the summertime, called Bentol, the bunker. And they still have UN presence up here. And these are Israeli soldiers. They're friendly. In fact, I had pictures of... So here's that UN building I just pointed out to you. Okay? So that's where that is. And again, you have all this front part is Israeli farmland. All this back here is Syrian. What I kind of say, I'm just going to flip through these pictures. These are kind of touristy looking places right now. Bunkers, you know, if they shoot at you, you'd like to have someplace to hide. You notice Washington, D.C. is this way, and it says it's 11,000 kilometers. And this is now the UN compound. You see how big they got. Okay. And you notice the wind generators over here. Some more of these pictures. At the top is this kind of a restaurant, very touristy at this point. But it could be activated, no doubt, if need to. This is the a town that was named, depends how you pronounce it, starts with a K or a Q, Kunetra or Kunetra. It is an abandoned Syrian town, and it was abandoned and as a political move. And so they can always look at, look what the Israelis did to us. And so it stands as a memorial to the war, but we know the real story. This is the abandoned place. You can see that it's a ruined place. Group of soldiers being talked to and trained. Again, that's the UN compound. Looking north, UN building. Lots of poppies grow wild. Pretty beautiful. And we're heading home. I'm pushing through here because it's almost 8 o'clock. Here's the tank. It's not a new one because it looked like a lot of dirt on it, so maybe it's being refurbished. And we come to our last story, Eli Cohn in the Golden Heights. Anybody seen the Impossible Spy movie? Nobody? Well, then you got a little treat for you. My wife waved her hand. She remembered the movie. Young Israeli husband Eli Cohn is recruited by the Mossad in the Secret Service for Israel in the early 1960s and sent to Syria. He was a furniture salesman from Argentina. That's the story. Telling his wife that he has a new job that requires extensive business travel, he takes up residence in Syria where he befriends a high-ranking Syrian government official and provides invaluable information to Israel. On a visit home, his wife pleads with him to leave his job so they can be home more, you know how the story goes. And his handler tells him that he has accomplished enough, but he decides to return to Syria one more time. Remember, this is an Israeli spy in Syria. One day, he learns of an attack on a kibbutz scheduled for that night. He abandons normal precautions in order to warn Israelis quickly as soon as possible and is caught. He gets on the radio and they intercept. They got Russian intercept radio and they catch him making the broadcast. So well was Eli accepted by the Syrians that they gave him a tour of the Golan Heights, almost a free run of it, it seemed like. Eli, with a photographic mind, remembers all the locations and the installations of the embattlements. He reports these to the Israeli High Intelligence Office. In one of the visits, he suggested the soldiers were suffering under the hot sun and the few eucalyptus trees would make their life much easier. The advice was taken by the Syrian workers and who marked every military installation for Israel, bombing them in 1967. Exactly happened. I looked that up to make sure that wasn't the story that was kind of added to it, but I think it was on Wikipedia or whatever. I looked it up, you know, it was told the same story. So that is true. So he's one of these kind of Jews that paid for his life, not a believer, you know, but is a part of what God was doing in Israel and making sure that Israel would be successful in the wars that they were needing to fight. So here we have an example of the eucalyptus tree, and I can just imagine this could have been one of the places where the Syrian bunkers were underneath, And so you just fly your airplanes and bomb wherever you see a eucalyptus tree, and that took care of it. Okay, now we're back to the Sea of Galilee. Does it look familiar to you? We're from the northeast. Now, we actually skipped some things. We got to go back and pick up, but I thought you might like to see the Sea of Galilee again one more time. All right, I'll pray and let you go. And if you have questions, some have asked about movies, and I'm always scared to recommend movies, but I have a list of movies up here that I've thought of, that I've talked about. If you want to look at it and see if you know all of those, that'd be okay. And if you have some that could be added to my list, I'd be glad to know about it, because it's kind of fun. Like somebody says, I don't want to read about it, I want to see a movie. All right. So for those people, we'll try to have movies. All right, let's pray now. Lord, thank you for the evening, for the weeks we've had together this year as we studied the land. Lord, it's been a rich time for me as I've studied it, and it's wonderful to reflect on what your word has said about the land and the people that live in it and what you're accomplishing in this world through the land. And Lord, in these late days of the church age, it would seem to us, we see things around the land degenerating, but Lord, the land itself is blossoming and it's growing, and we're realizing it has another cycle of judgment to come yet. But Lord, we see when your hand is involved and the people are back in the land, how the land prospers and how it accepts the people and produces for them, and they love the land. But do pray for our Christian or our Jewish friends that they would come to know Christ, even our minimal contacts with them. But Lord, we never know exactly what will be used. We know that there are those that do come to Christ by witnesses that witnessing that's been left. So we just pray for their souls, that they might come to know the Savior. And perhaps maybe they don't become saved now, but will during the tribulation become part of those that witness at that time. Lord, we just want to be faithful to be with the word and give it out as we have the opportunity. Again, thank you for our weeks together, for the joy we have serving in this church, and for the fellowship we have with one another, and pray, Lord, as you go, keep us faithful during the summer months and bring us back in the fall, and we'll give you the praise and glory for all that's accomplished. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.